Good morning, Kansas City. Welcome to Free Market Underground, where every week we bring you all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager for Butler Lands and Wagler. Free Market Underground is produced every week by Mr. Martell Love, and the show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. Good morning, Mr. Martell Love.
Good morning, Mr. Chris Butler. How's it going?
Good. We had a great conversation yesterday on the NFL, something that nobody in their right mind would pay me to listen to my opinions on, but was more than willing to give them.
Yes, and you did a great job.
Well, thanks. I am a fan. and you've got something coming up tonight that for all these Chiefs fans is meaningful, because if we win this game tonight, we likely go to the playoffs.
Likely.
If we lose, I'd say the chances are almost nil. Not only that, Martell, I want to get your thought on this. If the Chiefs do not win tonight, is there going to be a huge shakeup at One Arrowhead Drive?
You know, Chris, that's a very interesting question. And my answer to that is, I think there has to be. I think there has to be. After you start a season 5-0 and you lose and you don't make the playoffs to a team that started 0-4, there has to be some changes. And I don't know if that starts at the top with Andy Reid. I don't know. You know, there's still the whole debacle that started at the beginning of the season with John Dorsey.
Right.
Now, he just was gone at the beginning, right, a week before the season started, which never happens for a general manager. And now you have this debacle of a season that we've had. I think something has to happen, whether that's a Marcus Peters trade, which you saw last week. All of a sudden, the Chiefs look like a different team. They look like the team they looked like at the beginning of the season.
Right.
And the only thing that missed was Marcus Peters.
Right.
The only thing they were missing.
Right. They're all pro corner.
They're all pro corner, who I still believe is one of the top corners in
Absolutely.
The league. I just think he's a cancer to this team.
Yeah.
So something has to change. Andy Reid, in this season, he's given up his play calling, which he's pretty much admitting, hey, I'm screwing up here. So something's going to have to change, Chris.
Yeah, I agree. You know what, though? Since he has turned over the reins on play calling, their offense has not been the problem. Now, they've still lost, but their offense has not been the problem. It's been the defense.
That's right. Defense came. They came to play last week with no Peters.
You're right. They did.
It's odd.
It is. And, you know, that's the reaction you were hoping for. You were hoping for a reaction of guys getting together and saying, look, we're going to have to make up for the loss of Marcus here. So let's play outside of ourselves for one game. Looks like they did that. So tonight is important for Chiefs fans. I will be watching. Martell will be working and watching. Is that right?
Absolutely. I'll be working, watching, and hoping we get a win.
No doubt. It'd be a shame to waste that 5-0 start.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really shame.
Yeah. In other news, Chris, though, I checked into picking myself up some Bitcoin this week. Is that is that a good idea?
You must be flush, my friend. One Bitcoin, Martell, how much do you think one Bitcoin is costing us these days?
It's probably, what, $100,000?
Nope, not yet.
Not yet?
That is the projection, though, for the end of next year. Right now, we are sitting at about 16,000. Do you remember me saying, though, a couple shows ago, I think it was either last show or the show before, that we were going to start trading Bitcoin futures, and that was going to start on a Sunday night. I think it was last Sunday night, right? So we're a week into Bitcoin futures. And futures are a derivative of the actual asset that's traded. It's a bet on price movements of something. For example, there are corn futures, which for speculators anyway, is a bet on the price of corn. Bitcoin futures are a bet on the price of Bitcoin, the future price of Bitcoin. And what that does is it allows people to bet that Bitcoin goes down or up. But if you don't have a futures market, the only speculation that could occur in that market was that the price went up. Now, I heard somebody on TV the other day say, hey, we could short Bitcoin before this futures market. Yeah, if you were a billionaire and were going to pay an investment bank to structure a product specifically for you, yeah, that's right. But the only way the average person could bet that Bitcoin prices go down would be through a futures market. Now we've got that. That did open on Sunday. And you have actually seen, I know this is weird, but you haven't seen Bitcoin go up much this week. The introduction of this futures market in Bitcoin has actually allowed for some downward price movement, believe it or not. I know that's amazing. You know, we got actually, this show is going to be a hodgepodge of a lot of different, there are a lot of different things going on right now, from Bitcoin to the net neutrality decision to thinking at the beginning of the week, we had a tax deal that the House and the Senate both could live with. And then suddenly you get Marco Rubio extorting the rest of the Republican Party, holding them hostage, basically, to get to buy more votes, basically. He wants to appear to be the guy that cares about the middle class. Now, we talked about this a couple of shows ago. Three different groups of people have graded or scored the Senate tax reform bill. And all three are utter nonsense, and that includes kind of a middle-of-the-road politically organization. It includes a left-leaning organization. It includes a right-leaning organization, and all of them come up with some fairly wacky ways to assess that plan. All I want to know is this. How much of a tax cut, percentage-wise, do people at the top get? How much of a tax cut, percentage-wise, do people in the middle get? And guess what? The people in the middle, on average, get about 20% of a cut in their taxes, and the people at the top get a tax cut of about 8%. Okay, so you cannot claim this is a tax cut for the rich, period. Marco Rubio wants to play on the, I guess you'd call it kind of the Democrats' playbook that this is a tax cut for the rich, and rather than just coming out and say exactly as I just did, 8% for the top quintile, 20% cut for the middle quintile. Instead, he wants to play on this notion that this is actually a tax cut for the rich and that I need to do something for the middle class so I can look like the white knight in this conversation and buy some votes the next time I go up for re-election. So that came out, what was that, Thursday? And I think by Friday morning, after President Trump had said he thought Marco would still vote for that bill, a lot of the anxiety in the markets was released, and people started to think, hey, this is going to get done one way or the other. It's interesting, though. All of these, and it's true of Democrats, too. I don't mean to pick on Republicans necessarily, but all of these Republicans that get the microphone in front of their face have their own little pet project that they want to get out of this tax bill. And it is politics. They'll come together, I think, and get something done for sure. But not one of them that has claimed this is what I want has proposed a way to pay for it. Because it actually, as much as I hate that phrase, pay for tax cuts, you can only have a $1.5 trillion budget gap. So if you're going to give more of a tax break, you have to take away a tax break from someone to pay for, well, in Marco Rubio's case, a child tax credit. So not one of these people wants to talk about what who we're going to take that proposed tax cut away from to pay for this pet project of mine. I don't want to talk about that. Still, though, I do think that something gets done. So this week we went through kind of a roller coaster on tax reform, had that interest rate increase announced on Wednesday, Janet Yellen's last hurrah, so to speak. We'll talk about that too. We'll talk a little bit about bubbles. We already talked about Bitcoin. I don't think you can talk about Bitcoin anymore without mentioning the word bubble. And we had actually, Martell, a great call on Friday morning. A caller named Jack asked, okay, exactly what is it that backs this currency, this Bitcoin thing? Is it convertible into anything? And his point was great because he pointed out, look, gold used to back our currency so that if you wanted to, you could bring your green dollar bills to your bank and say, can I have this in gold, please? And they'd convert it into gold. Now it's a fiat currency and it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, which is, it's hard to say that without laughing, but it is backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government. If you look at any other currency that's out there, it is backed by something. As flimsy as it might sound, it is backed by something, someone's promise. What about Bitcoin? And the thing to remember about all currencies is that anything can be used as a currency, and the market determines the value of that currency. And just like anything, any good, any service in our economy, and Bitcoin is no exception, its value is derived by what you can do with it. And in this case, the promise of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is that it can be used as a means of exchange, a medium of exchange. The problem is Bitcoin is not being used as a medium of exchange. It is being used as an electronic form of Beanie Babies. It is a collectible asset, and people are buying it really because, and this is the scary part, when people buy something simply because they think that it is going to go up in price and for no other reason, well, you better make sure there is an easy way to assess the intrinsic value of that thing, like a stock. A stock, you're buying it with the expectation that it goes up in value, but you also have a way to evaluate the intrinsic value of that stock. It is the profit that that company that issued the stock is going to make over the next 3, 5, 10, infinity years. That's how you assess the value of a stock. What about Bitcoin? Well, we'll talk more about that when we talk about bubbles. Right now, we need to take a break. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust on KCMO Talk Radio 710 and 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we talk about all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. And just talked a little bit about a lot of things, and we're going to talk more about a lot of things as the show progresses today. I want to take just a second to give you an update on the show's website, freemarketunderground.com. We are designing a brand new website for Butler Lands and Wagler, and so we're going through some pains here with the freemarketunderground.com page. Ostensibly, you're going to be able to go there to get audio archives and the show notes, the charts that I normally post. That is going to be available. Unfortunately, the job of updating that website is no longer in my hands and won't be until the website's completed. Once it's completed, I'm pretty good about updating that stuff in a timely fashion. Until the website is completed, it is out of my hands and there's not much I can do about it. Sometimes it's updated on time, sometimes it's not. Go there, check it out, freemarketunderground.com. If everything that you're looking for is not uploaded on any given Saturday or Sunday, check back on Monday, check back on Tuesday. We're trying to get this company to speed up the process of updating that page. Be sure and check that out eventually, and I will let you know when everything is back in my control and I can update it on a regular basis. In the interim, be sure and check out the Facebook page, Free Market Underground. I usually update that daily with free market stories, news items that you might find interesting. If you like it, please do like it. Follow us for sure so that you can get that on your news feed, your Facebook news feed. Just do a search for at Free Market Underground on Facebook. All of that technology, that tech, should be updated relatively quickly, hopefully within the next 4 weeks. Of course, I would like it to be done quicker than that. If it's not, trust me, it will get done soon, and I apologize for any inconvenience. Want to turn, if we can, to inflation. We actually had a couple of economic reports. One of them is was great. It was retail sales, and retail sales has been one of my favorite metrics to make fun of because we haven't had very good numbers for a long time. U.S. retail sales surged at their fastest rate since 2012. Okay, we just got that this week for November. These are November retail sales. Up 0.8%. That's a huge move for a month. 0.8% in November. The annual growth rate is now at 5.8%, and that is the highest since 2012. So that's a five-year, actually, it's about a five-and-a-half-year high, almost 6%. But here's the thing. About a third of that 0.8% increase was gasoline station sales, and that means people were paying higher prices for gas. Or I should say, that's what that usually means. And that's not the kind of spending increase you want. You want people to be buying more things. If we're talking about gasoline, you'd like to see people buying more gas, more gallons of gas, not the same amount of gas, but at a higher price. I strongly suspect that's what that was. So a third of our huge November increase was probably not for the right reason. Still, things looked pretty good. Online sales were absolutely skyrocketing in November. The only thing that gained more in November than gasoline was online sales, up 2.5% for the month. And if 0.8% is a big move, 2.5% is astronomical. The only category of sales, retail sales, down in the month of November was autos and auto parts. We overproduced cars. I don't think too many people would argue with that. And we put new automobiles in the garages of a lot of people that, and to do it, we stretched out their loan payments, really went out of our way to make sure everybody was buying a new car on very easy terms. And what you do when you do that is eventually it catches up to you and nobody needs a new car anymore. And we're kind of at that point right now. Other big winners in this retail sales report were furniture, electronics, building materials, restaurants, and strangely, sporting goods. Sporting goods. Baseball bats, gloves, football helmets, pads, shoulder pads, sailing equipment, camping gear.
The value went up on those things?
Yeah, we got more sales in November of sporting goods.
Really?
Oh, yeah. But it must be, it's probably holiday shopping.
Maybe.
I would think, unless everybody decided to take up field hockey.
I never got a baseball bat for Christmas.
You didn't?
No.
I think I have, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, as a kid, of course. Actually, and then after you get out of college, as you well know, Martel, and you start to think that you're still somewhat athletic.
Right,
you join those softball leagues.
Yes.
And people might give you a softball bat
sure. For
Christmas, right? The aluminum kind that you can smash the ball out of the park just about every at-bat.
Yes.
With that's the kind of league I liked.
Are you a softball player?
I was.
Were you?
Yeah. Up until about age 35, and then it just the body just
is that when you realized I just don't have it anymore.
Don't have it anymore. No. And you know what? My life is complete without softball.
Yeah.
It is fairly complete.
Maybe you should take up bowling.
Yeah, no, that's up my alley,
yes.
If you'll pardon the pun.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Now, that's right. People shift from those relatively athletic things in their 20s and 30s to bowling. Yeah, I'm ready for the bowling. The other thing that happened this week that we learned about was inflation. And PPI, Producer Price Index, this is the price of the things that producers of those baseball bats, the things that they're buying to make those bats, those materials, the aluminum, it's a price index of those things that go into products. And that is really pushing up. And I think I have this on the Facebook page, a chart. We're at a six-year high on PPI growth. Okay, people are talking about no inflation, and obviously I've tried to refute that by talking about how we used to measure inflation, and clearly we have inflation. But the statistics that our government agencies use today are saying we're not having much inflation. Well, now they're starting to show a little bit of inflation. Okay, it looks like the worm has turned a little bit, and I don't know that we're going to continue to get a firming up of inflation, because CPI wasn't that hot, but it was up 0.4 in November, and it was expected. It didn't beat expectations, but that's a decent number. And the annual total inflation rate for consumer prices, CPI, is 2.2%. That is relatively high, but the markets were disappointed because if you strip out food and energy, that inflation rate wasn't that high, and it was actually less than expected, I think 1.7%. So as much as it pains me to say that that's disappointing, I frankly like lower prices, but the market likes it when it sees inflation for reasons we don't really have time to get into right now. But it is a ridiculous sentiment. But I think if you look at the way markets reacted to some of this inflation news, it begs the question, are you ready in case inflation starts to grip this economy? Because there are some asset classes that perform well in an inflationary environment and some don't. Are you prepared just in case? We need to take a break. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust, heard on KCMO Talk Radio 710 AM and 103.7 FM as well.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we engage you in thoughtful discourse about our economy and our markets. My name is Chris Butler, Portfolio Manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. And we're going to talk about something that, honestly, I didn't really think we'd ever have to talk about. It wasn't that long ago that I was so curious that I did kind of a deep dive on this subject. And like I said, didn't think it would ever come up again. So I kind of wasted my time. Now, of course, it's come up and I didn't waste my time. And I'm talking about net neutrality, internet neutrality. Because this was a stink. It was a huge stink. People protesting and some comments were made at this hearing of the FCC, which were just mind-numbing. I mean, the only thing missing was blaming Republicans for killing internet users, which I half expected to hear. Or you could make the case, you could make the case that if, as expected, the internet is now going to cost us all $700 a day to use, that we're killing people because they won't have enough money left over to buy health insurance. Now, I'm sure we will hear that. I'm surprised I haven't heard it yet. I could have made the case. I mean, I was thinking that's what we were going to hear. The FCC voted 3-2 along party lines to roll back net neutrality rules all the way back to the Stone Age days of the internet, the early days, 2015. Do you remember how expensive the internet was back in 2015 when we were all paying $1,000 a day for internet access? Well, we're going back there, going back to those Stone Age days. We're going to decivilize back to 2015. Of course, I am being really sarcastic, and I'll knock it off now. The Democrats called this, quote unquote, internet destroying. And I do intend to hold them to that. In 1 year after this is, and I don't think it's anywhere near a done deal yet. It's got to be approved and it'll be tested in court. In 1 year after rolling back net neutrality. I want to see if the internet has indeed been destroyed. I guess like it was in 2014, right? A telecom industry association lawyer was talking about this, and he said that net neutrality stifled competition and deterred investment. But a Democrat on the commission, the FCC commission, blasted the FCC for siding against the quote-unquote will of the people, okay? So it's interesting from a rhetorical standpoint to consider what's being said here. On the one side, you have stifling of competition and deterring investment. On the other side, you hear that they're acting against the will of the people. But I'm not real sure we ought to make a big deal out of the will of the people at a bureaucratic level. Okay, the will of the people can be expressed in a voting booth. If they want government to regulate the internet, they can vote for it. Even then, just because 75% of the folks polled, and this is true, 75% of the folks polled are against rolling back net neutrality, doesn't mean that all 75% of them aren't wrong. Okay, the will of the people needs to be tempered, number one. Number two, the right way to express the will of the people is not through an agency. It is through Congress. So if you really want your internet regulated by the government, you ought to have that ability to walk into a voting booth in November and vote for the people that'll do it. Give Congress the ability to regulate the internet. Take it out of the hands of an agency that created net neutrality by fiat, by dictate. And that's what net neutrality is. And I'll be the first to admit, by the way, I'm a little mushy on this. I see both sides of the argument. And I guess I lean toward the Telecom Industry Association lawyer who said that net neutrality would stifle and has stifled, actually, competition and deterred investment. The head of the FCC, a guy by the name of, and I apologize if I am not pronouncing his name correctly. I think it's pronounced Sajit Pai. He said, and I totally agree with him, Title II, which is the net neutrality regulation, didn't create the open internet, and Title II isn't necessary to maintain it. I agree. He also said that there would remain powerful checks to make sure that internet service providers don't take advantage of consumers. Okay, well, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Once again, the left has beaten the right on PR, on rhetoric. The name net neutrality is a rhetorical victory in and of itself. To be pro-net neutrality, you have to be in favor of additional government regulation and the cronyism and the bureaucracy that goes with it. That's net neutrality. Internet service providers, or what they call ISPs, used to price bandwidth. This is the crux of what's going on with this. The ISPs used to price bandwidth, assuming that on average, people would not hit their bandwidth allowances, their maximum bandwidth allowance. Okay? But then services like Netflix and YouTube came along, and they just sucked bandwidth. They were bandwidth intensive. And that cost these ISPs, these internet service providers, more and more money to provide that kind of service to everyone, okay, with a limited amount of bandwidth. So the standard costs for standard bandwidth packages at these ISPs started to climb. And ISPs responded by restricting access to high bandwidth using sites like Netflix. They also started to artificially slow down downloads. And people did not like that, understandably. I totally understand that. Net neutrality is against all of those practices. Net neutrality requires internet service providers to treat all web traffic the same, even though all web traffic is not the same. There is no limiting of access with net neutrality. No reducing up or download speeds with net neutrality. Since 2005, though, several times the FCC has done what agencies do, and that is power grab. They've tried to regulate internet service providers, but courts have always struck down these attempts at a power grab, saying that's not your purview. So in 2015, the FCC did what any good agency would do. They redefined broadband internet as a telecom service and then passed net neutrality rules because they were then within their rights to do that. Now, again, this is done at an agency level. This is not Congress. This gets no authority, no approval from Congress, doesn't get authority or approval from the executive branch. Certainly the Supreme Court has absolutely no say in doing this. This is done at an agency level. Okay. There is merit to both sides. I hope I've done a good job explaining this, that there is merit on both sides of this debate. We know the internet service providers might slow broadband hogging websites or access to them, because Comcast did just that in 2014 to Netflix, if you remember. That was kind of a big story in 2014, maybe not huge, but I do remember the story. Internet service providers like Comcast have done very little to drive public support their way. Okay, and they have done absolutely nothing to make themselves look good in this thing. And that's why there were a lot of people picketing Verizon, for example, Wednesday. A lot of boycotts and picketing going on because of this. Now, despite what I consider to be some pretty fair points coming from the pro-net neutrality camp, arguments against the FCC rollback, I do think, are somewhat lacking. If streaming video is generating a lot of the ISP's expenses, you can probably expect that some kind of cost-sharing agreement is going to surface between, say, an ISP and Netflix, or an ISP and YouTube. YouTube is also a bandwidth hogging website. Nor are these corporations that support net neutrality very altruistic as they want you to believe them to be. Google and Facebook seek to block internet service providers from trading in users' private information, a trade on which those companies themselves depend. So net neutrality eliminates their competition. And this is one of the problems with regulation. You get people able to beat up on other people using the regulation for their own good. They don't want ISPs trading in users' private information so that they get the right to do that. They're trying to use this regulation for their own gain. Let's not forget the history of the internet either. It's a history of market, free market activity. It's bottom-up grassroots development and evolution. It is not about, has never been about, top-down regulation or control. If you're cool with the internet as it is now, I'm not sure why you'd want to freeze the evolution of it at its current state by turning over the reins to a politically motivated bureaucracy. The ISP's increased revenue from a non-neutral internet would enable the expansion of broadband networks, which could, and the argument is that it would, end regional monopolies. Now, that's the economics behind this thing. You want to free up, if it's going to cost Comcast, for example, a lot of money to continue to allow people to hog bandwidth, let them charge more for those folks that go to those websites and have the bandwidth that they want. Charge them for it. Then what you would see is you would see Comcast then have the money to go out and build out the infrastructure. Ultimately, more supply will drive down the prices. Okay, but here's the last point, and then we have to take a break. If you're really serious about wanting the government to regulate the internet, then by all means, there is a way to do that. Feel free. However, what I personally am against is that there is no democracy in the way that a bureaucratic agency like the FCC can control and regulate the internet. Having Congress do it is one thing. Having an agency to do it is another, because Congress is subject to more direct democracy. You get to vote for those people. And if you don't want the government to regulate it, you don't vote for the people that are in favor of it, period. And that way, the majority opinion rules. But before that point, we have to understand that there are risks and rewards of both sides of that story. And I hope I illuminate at least some of those today. We need to take a break. You're listening to Free Market Underground on KCMO Talk Radio 710 AM, now heard on 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust, where every week we try to make a little bit of sense out of our world. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. And I said earlier we'd talk about bubbles. I want to talk about that in this segment. Conroy Investments was started by two former analysts of Bridgewater Associates. Bridgewater is one of the world's largest hedge funds, and it's run by a guy by the name of Ray Dalio, who has a lot of respect in this investment world. And Conroy tries to explain asset price bubbles this week. Interesting article. Dramatic rises in asset prices caused by euphoria, excitement, enthusiasm. That's what they're really trying to get at. Why are bubbles even possible? And what they come up with is this, and I don't have a problem, by the way, with this psychological explanation. It is that every one of us has two investors inside of ourselves. And one is a value investor that's constantly thinking about if things are too expensive to buy right now. And the other investor is a momentum investor who's constantly thinking, am I missing out on something, some opportunity somewhere? Well, we've got both of those. All of us has both of those little investors inside of our head. They go on, Conroy Investments, to find an interesting way of measuring a bubble. And you can do it with every asset class, stocks, Bitcoin, bonds. And they look at something called serial correlation in prices. And that's neither here nor there, but I do find that to be a clever argument in measuring bubbles. So they've reframed the question, why do bubbles arise, to become, how do assets get so highly serially correlated? And they're asking the same thing, but phrased differently. And their answer to this question is, when there isn't a clear framework around value, momentum mindset can take over. Most of the time, the momentum investor in us doesn't want to miss out on something, but that investor behavior or mentality is checked by our other internal investor, and he's a value investor who has this focus on price and cost and value. When the value investor in us gets muzzled because she doesn't understand or know how to value something, and the authors use Bitcoin as an example, our return-chasing momentum investor is the only internal investor that's allowed to speak. And so we end up chasing return, and we bid up asset prices, and you get bubbles. And by the way, according to the authors, yes, Bitcoin qualifies as a bubble because it's got an extremely high serial correlation value, something I'm not going to explain. It's not necessary. But my point is that the authors are not wrong, but they're only partly right. Psychology can explain our desire to behave in a certain way, but they're forgetting an important piece of the puzzle. To act, we need the willingness to act. And that may very well be explained by this psychology that they've come up with. But we also need the means to act. And in the case of asset price bubbles, and that Bitcoin or stocks or bonds, I'm talking about money. We would never have a bubble, not in railroad stocks, not in tech stocks, not in internet stocks, not in tulips, not in New World exploration journeys, if we didn't constantly print money. And when we print a bunch of money, we get a bunch of bubbles. When we print a little more money year after year, we get slow developing bubbles year after year. Without more money consistently, constantly being printed and then injected into our economy, every dollar we invest in Bitcoin would have to come from some other investment, say Facebook stock. And the second you start making people choose between their investments, you eliminate the bubble, or at least you dampen it considerably. And the Bitcoin still might go up. People might sell all of their Facebook and buy Bitcoin, but it wouldn't be a bubble. People are making rational decisions at that point. If people had to choose between a car and Bitcoin, and by the way, they're priced about the same right now, one Bitcoin or a car, would there be a bubble in Bitcoin? No. It might go up, but it would be well-grounded in a very well-thought-out decision-making process. We'd have to give up something to get something else. Well, in the world we live in now, we don't have to torture ourselves like that. If the Fed keeps printing money, that is. Now we can have the car and the Bitcoin. Now we can keep Facebook stock and still get Bitcoin. That's how you get bubbles. The bottom line is this: all the errors in rational thought, or all the enthusiasm we might have for a new technology, is a necessary condition for a bubble, but it is not sufficient. We also need to supply the market with enough money to make some crazy investment decisions. Without more and more money being injected into our economy, all the enthusiasm is just that. Enthusiasm. It's excitement. It's a talking point. It might get news. It might be talked about around the water cooler, might be talked about in the coffee house. But that's all it is, and that's where it ends. Because once you have to start selling something and then moving the proceeds into Bitcoin, well, now you're talking about having to make a much more rational decisions. It gives you, in a sense, a restriction. If you're not printing money all the time, you're restricted to make investment decisions given a sum of money. I hope that makes sense, because that is the world we live in. The world we live in is one where the federal government and the Federal Reserve don't want us to have to torture ourselves in making decisions about whether or not to own Facebook or Bitcoin. We might as well have them both, and here's the money to do it. That's the world you live in, and it has some rather dramatic implications if you think about it. That would not be the case with a constant money supply, or one that just goes up by a tiny amount every year even. But once you start seeing your money supply grow at 10 and 20% per year, and maybe not 20, but certainly between 5 and 15% per year, you better be looking out for bubbles. And that's where we're at. That's the world we live in. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for Don Wales, Protecting Your Retirement. That comes up next. This show is sponsored by Butler, Lands, and Wagler. Thanks for listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust. Thanks to Martel Love for production. Until next Saturday, have a great week.